we're both fine with the lectern.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you can sit here if you want. Those mics will be on as well, so. It's not even 6 o'clock yet. I'm just moving house just now, so it's like sort of checking for emails and all that stuff. Yeah. So much to do. So I'm just renting somewhere just now because I'm sort of. I don't know whether to move back to Scotland. But I wanted to move somewhere. But I was like, do hold on for 2 years and just stay around. I was like, I felt kind of sick of it. So it's quite a nice place. But it's just like all the usual. And then it's like in 2 years' time, maybe 3 when I'm 30, and so deciding whether I want to do Scotland or whether I want to do. I know I'm kicking the decision down the road, but that's not necessarily the worst idea, though.
There's a lot to put down if you think you're moving.
Yeah, just as a look for all that. It's a bit bad thing. How's your best might be to do? I felt like it was a bit quick. So many strugglers.
We'll slow it down to one side of the bike now.
Is that you that does all the talking?
Yeah.
That, to be fair, I normally just read from it, but I normally know it. But I've not actually done the last 2 talks. I was on holiday in Australia for like a month over Christmas, so I missed 2 talks in a row. So I'm kind of going to go by the words tonight. If you wing it, it always goes wrong. Once she closes that door, we'll kick off. But I'm presuming there's a couple of people just waiting to sign up. Yeah, the usual.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to this evening's programme top of the Staple Inn Actuarial Society. My name's Jonathan Bordley, and I'm the Honorary Secretary for SIAS. Just before I begin tonight's talk, I have a couple of notices about upcoming SIAS events. So our next social event is going to be on the 20th of February, and it's our annual pool tournament held at Riley's Victoria. You can find out more about the event and purchase your tickets on our website. And our next programme event is going to be on Monday, the 2nd of March. In response to members' feedback, for our 2020 events programme, we're actually running 3 different talks about actuaries in non-traditional roles. So this first talk is actually going to cover some of the issues you might need to consider if you're asked to advise a funeral trust or a religious-based funeral expenses scheme. It's quite an interesting and different sort of talk. Further details of the talk and online booking are also available on our website. So next, I just have the few standard notices about tonight's event. So just a reminder that tonight's event is hosted by SIAS. We do encourage those of you who are not SIAS members to sign up. Membership is exceptionally good value at £26 for IFOA fellows and £15 for IFOA students. And again, further details are set out on our website. There's also an attendance sheet in the small room just outside the hall. If you didn't sign this on the way in, don't forget to sign it on your way out, as attendance at these talks does not automatically get added to your CPD record. So remember to update your CPD in the normal way after tonight's event. And we're also eager for our talks to run as smoothly and effectively as possible, so we'd be delighted to hear any feedback that you might have. We'll email you a short online survey after the talk, so if you could please just take a couple of minutes to fill that out, we'd be delighted to hear your views. Just a reminder that if the fire alarm does sound during tonight's event, please exit using the fire vents at the back. And then just a reminder to put your phones to silent, please. So tonight's talk is going to last around 1 hour and be followed by a Q&A with the speakers. If you have a question, please raise your hand and someone will bring you a microphone. We value everyone's contributions at our talks, so there is a bottle of champagne on offer for the best question from an IFOA student and also the best question from an IFOA fellow. If you could please state your name and what category you fall in before you asked your question, and so we're able to categorise you. Following the meeting and the talk, there's going to be sandwiches and networking drinks in the hall outside, just where you signed in, so please do remember to join us if you're able to. So back to tonight's talk, we have Jinesh and Rob here. Jignesh is an Associate Director at PwC, specialising in financial reporting and regulation. He has supported a number of insurers on IFRS 17 over the past couple of years and is leading the UK firm's thinking on the IFRS 17 risk adjustment. Rob is also an Associate Director at PwC, specialising in finance change and financial reporting. He is working with a number of companies on IFRS 17 implementation and is also a member of the IFOA CSM working party. So I'll pass you over to Rob and Jignesh.
Thanks, Jonathan. Thanks for the introduction, and thank everyone for attending today. So, as a quick intro, a quick disclaimer first. So, these are our own views, not those of the Institute or SIAS, or of PwC. So, quick overview of the agenda. We conducted a survey as part of PwC on the risk adjustment. We want to go through the results of that survey today, focusing mainly on implementation challenges that UK life insurance firms are having in implementing the IFRS 17 risk adjustment. We cover areas where there's broad agreement across the industry, where there's areas of disagreement, and where the industry still needs to decide on their approach. We then summarise some of the key practical challenges that are being faced by life insurers at the moment, and some of the solutions that they're thinking of to tackle those challenges. And then we conclude at the end and have time for Q&A at the end as well. We've done this talk four times now. Well, this is the fourth time. It's worked best when we've had interaction throughout, so we do encourage questions as we go through as well as at the end, noting that we do need you to say your name when you ask questions. So at the end of any section or slide, if you want to ask questions, please do raise your hand. We'll try and cover it at that point. So a bit of background on our survey. We conducted a survey in September 2019 where 13 large UK life insurers took part. Small caveat, it is a few months ago now, so some of the results we present may have moved on, but having worked with a number of insurers on this, I think most of the results are still pretty valid. Off the back of the survey, we hosted a roundtable with those insurers to discuss the survey results and delve into the details in a bit more depth. We've then supplemented our findings in this pack with our hands-on experience of supporting UK life insurers with IFRS 17 implementation. I'll hand over to Rob now to cover some of the areas where there's broad agreement across the industry.
Thanks, Jignesh. So as Jignesh said, first area that we've got is areas where there was broad agreement across the industry, or at least across the participants from the survey that we ran and the roundtable discussion. So first area here of broad agreement is in the overall approach to calculating the risk adjustment. Now, I'm kind of conscious there's probably going to be varied experience and knowledge of IFRS 17 throughout the room, so I'll go through some of the background and basics as we talk through this to hopefully try and get everyone broadly onto the same page as we go through this, but we do only have an hour as well. So in overall approach, IFRS 17 doesn't specify how you calculate the risk adjustment. It requires that the risk adjustment represents the compensation that entity requires for taking on the non-financial risk associated with a group of contracts. There's a few principles that are set out in the standard that do need to be adhered to, but there's flexibility and there's judgment required in terms of how an individual entity actually comes up with that. What we're seeing from the question that we asked, what approach are you using to calculate the risk adjustment, is that the majority of our UK-based companies responding to the survey were using a value-at-risk-based measure. And by that, I mean they'll calculate a value at risk at defined confidence intervals and will, in a lot of cases, back solve to find some margins or provisions for adverse deviation, where we've referred to it as a PAD, but margins that you could apply to your demographic assumptions when carrying out your cash flow runs that would equate to those VAR metrics, basically. So we've seen it referred to as a VAR-based approach or a calibrated margins approach. But this was where there seemed to be the most kind of consensus at the overall level around the participants from our survey. We are aware that others outside of the UK especially may be following a cost of capital approach. There were a minority of participants from our survey following this approach, but we have seen it more from non-UK or global companies just from other experience as well. Reasons that tended to be given for following a value at risk based or calibrated margin approach from the roundtable, partly around volatility. So there was a concern that following a cost of capital type approach could introduce more volatility into your IFRS 17 results in terms of particularly movement in your market risk over time. Allocation down to unit of account level, which is a topic that I'll come back to a little bit later in the presentation. But that was another reason that that people chose a value at risk-based or calibrated margins approach. And the last one was actually around the working day timetable. Again, a point I'll expand on a little bit more later, but essentially we've seen companies who have started by thinking, how can I leverage as much as possible what I already have? So can I take a cost of capital-based approach that might leverage what I already do for Solvency II, for example? We've seen companies start to run into problems with that in thinking through the working day timetable implications in terms of when do I normally have that available for Solvency II versus how early in my IFRS reporting timetable am I going to need a risk adjustment available, which might be in the first couple of days of the reporting cycle. We will come back to that topic a bit later because that is one of the key kind of operational considerations that some companies have started to think about, but not particularly on a widespread basis. I think that's the main kind of first area in terms of broad consensus from our participants. Next area that we've got is around transition. So again, a bit of background and context here for those who are less familiar with IFRS 17. IFRS 17 sets out the requirements that need to be followed for all of your business going forward from the transition date or from the date, from the period before IFRS 17 goes live. For any of your in-force business at the transition date before IFRS 17 goes live, there's a range of approaches set out in the standard. So the default approach is what's called a full retrospective approach, which essentially says, pretend that IFRS 17 has always been around, go back to when your in-force business incepted and carry out your CSM calculations and your BEL and risk adjustment calculations since that date, roll it forward in order to get a CSM at the point of transition. It's a very quick run through transition. We could fill a whole another talk with that, but I want to give a little bit of background for people. If it's impracticable to do that, to go back to when this business was first issued, calculate, say, a risk adjustment at inception and changes in that over time, then you don't follow a full retrospective approach. If it's impracticable, which is defined in IAS 8, you then have a free choice between following a modified retrospective approach or a fair value approach. The modified retrospective approach, without going into too much detail on this, is essentially the full retrospective approach with some specified modifications that you can apply if you need to. The fair value approach involves no historic data or retrospective calculations at all. It's a point in time calculation at the transition date. A little bit of background there, but the relevance for this is if any part of your CSM calculation from inception up to the transition date, if any part of it is impracticable, then you're automatically into the case of free choice between those two alternative methods. So if it's impracticable to calculate a risk adjustment for your in-force business at an historic point in time, then the full retrospective approach is impracticable. So the question we asked the participants is, how far back do you think it's going to be practicable or going to be feasible to calculate a risk adjustment based only on what you knew at that point in time? So part of the criteria for impracticability, is this practicable for you to do it, involves do you have the data and assumptions, essentially can you do this? But there's another criteria which is around hindsight. So any historic calculations need to be based only on what you knew at that point in time, not based on what you've learnt since then. So the question here is, how far back could you go and calculate a risk adjustment following your accounting policy for risk adjustment based only on what you had available and what you knew at that point in time? So this is an area we've said there is broad agreement amongst our participants, essentially because they mostly converged around a year of around 2016 to 2017. What we're saying there is, as we approach IFRS 17, I can go back and calculate what my risk adjustment would have been at year end 19, year end 18, year end 17, possibly year end 16. Go back any further than that, and I can't calculate this in a way that doesn't involve hindsight or that I have the data assumptions available to do it. Now, from the discussion around the round table, key thing that seemed to be driving that was Solvency II, essentially. So 2016-17 is around the time where companies were starting to implement, build internal models, or start to prepare for Solvency II. So a common view that we had around the table was, I have a view of compensation for risk with available metrics around 2016, 2017, and since, that I could legitimately use as this is how I would have implemented my risk adjustment policy at that point in time. Go back any further than that, and I don't feel I have anything that I can objectively point to and say this is how I would have applied that at that point in time. Dignesh put up the disclaimer at the start of these are not our views. Well, these are not SIAS views, these are not PwC views. There's points in this, I'll say these are not necessarily our views either. These are the views of the participants of our survey. So I think the key thing for me on this one is engage with your auditors. So this is where companies are from our survey at the moment. It's a big kind of challenge and topic for debate as to what does impracticable really mean. And in the discussions with auditors, actually, are they satisfied that this is as far back as you can go? Or even that the information that you say you have there is, it meets the criteria for impracticability. So are you introducing hindsight, for example? The other point I'll pick up on just while we're on transition is, I mentioned earlier that if it is impracticable, you're into a situation where you have a free choice between a modified retrospective approach and a fair value approach. Part of the discussion around the table did touch on the modified retrospective approach, and it is something that we have seen kind of throughout industry, people taking more interest in, if I put it that way. If you are in the situation where a full retrospective calculation is impracticable, there are, I'd say, varied views throughout industry on how useful some of the modifications are under the modified approach. I'd say there's quite a common view that the risk adjustment one could actually potentially be quite useful to companies implementing IFRS 17. So given that in that situation you have a free choice, if you want to take a retrospective approach, you like the financial results that you'd expect from that, for example, the modified retrospective approach could be quite useful to companies here in terms of being able to calculate the risk adjustment following that modification. Next topic we've got in terms of broad agreement is the diversification approach. So I should just be clear on what we're talking about here. So IFRS 17 is very clear that when you're calculating the risk adjustment for a group of business, an annual cohort of business that you've issued, you're allowing for the compensation that you as an entity need for writing that business, which may well reflect diversification within your entity. If you write longevity business, you write mortality business, you write protection business, you're pricing each of those, the compensation you require for taking those on may well reflect the diversification that you get within an entity. What I should clarify we're not talking about here is diversification in terms of reinsurance or in terms of groups, local entities within groups. We're going to come back to those points later on. So what we asked companies was how are you planning on allowing for diversification within your risk adjustment calculation? And there's definitely a strong kind of correlation here with the first slide I put up in terms of the overall approach. So if you are taking a calibrated margins approach, you've calculated a value at risk, you've back solved the margins that you need to apply to your cash flows to get to that, you're carrying out that cash flow modelling at a relatively granular level. You're calculating it at least at the level of your IFRS 17 unit of account, an annual group of business. So you don't really have the issue of a higher level diversification benefit that you need to try and allocate down to an annual cohort. So this kind of most common response here tended to align with, I'm following a margins-based approach, I'm doing a kind of bottom-up calculation of the diversification benefit here, in that when I calibrate those margins, I'm already allowing for that diversification benefit there. For those who aren't following that kind of approach, I think this probably falls more into the bucket of not got too far with the thinking yet, something to think about and to consider as we go through this. Last area I've got in terms of broad agreement is, looks particularly niche. Wouldn't be an IFRS 17 talk without an obscure alphanumeric code, I think. So I'll explain the impact of S118 on reinsurance risk adjustment. So the topic here is, under IFRS 17, you're required to calculate your risk adjustment for gross business that you issue and for reinsurance that's held separately. One of the questions that was raised to the ISB was, in calculating my gross risk adjustment, compensation I need for taking on this block of business, can I allow for reinsurance that I know I'm going to take out on it? I think particularly in the protection market, it's very common for insurers to write volumes of business knowing that they're taking out reinsurance or taking out that reinsurance basically at the same time as writing this business. The question was, can I take into account the reduction in risk, how I reflect that in my compensation, the reinsurance that I'm going to take out, given the separate calculation. Now, the S118, this was answered by the ISB in one of their kind of question log and responses in April last year. S118 was the question number on this. And the answer essentially here was, yes, you can take account for the reduction in risk benefit that you would get from this, as long as you also take into account the cost of obtaining that reinsurance. Now, most companies and participants to our survey, their response on this was, we are not planning on reflecting that at all, cost or benefit. We are doing a gross calculation, ignoring any kind of reinsurance that may or may not be taken out on this. I think there was one company in our survey that said they are planning on allowing for it. The general response was, I don't see that I'm going to get a significant benefit from the complexity this introduces into the calculation. One point I would caveat on this, it's not a choice in that IFRS 17 says you can choose between option A or option B. IFRS 17 sets out principles on how to calculate a risk adjustment. The method may differ by entity because it's based on how the entity measures a compensation for risk. So it's not, I'm going to choose whether to reflect this or not. It's, again, discussion with auditors. This is how I view compensation for risk. So when I think about the compensation I need, do I think about reinsurance that I'm going to be taking out, the cost and benefit associated with that? That was the last area I had in terms of areas of broad agreement. Jignesh is going to cover areas of varied proposals, but I'll just pause and see if there's any questions on the first section. Yeah.
My name's Derek Pike. In terms of the overall approach, did you get any feel for how companies intend to calibrate approach, other than the cost of capital is fairly obvious, but the PADS especially. There's a kind of implication from the next slide that they're taking Solvency II as a starting point. And I don't know, I mean, one approach I've seen is to take a a critical scenario based on your Solvency II SCR and use that to calibrate pads. But did you get any feeling of the calibration methods?
So I won't go too much into this now. So the way that we've set this out is areas of broad agreement, areas of varied proposals, and areas that are undecided. So without wanting to completely spoil the end of and give the game away for the end, we are coming back to calibration and kind of choice of confidence interval in the undecided section, which might well give you a clue of where the discussion went with that one. There is clearly a desire to leverage from Solvency II. I think we did kind of, in the discussion and in discussions we've had since, there are issues associated with that. I think we're going to cover some of those later on, but Jignesh, I don't know if there's any that you want to kind of add to now on that.
Yeah, so the combined scenario approach is a common approach that we're seeing people look to implement. I think one of the challenges will be my next slide in terms of under Solvency II, all of your risks are calibrated on a one-year view, so you look at your 99.5th percentile on over the next one-year period. We don't think that's necessarily appropriate for IFRS 17, where you should perhaps consider a longer time period, and therefore, although you may be able to derive a combined scenario, that would probably require some adjustment under IFRS 17 compared to Solvency II.
Any other questions before we move on to the next section?
So the next section is where there's disagreement amongst the industry at the moment and where some of the results get a bit more interesting. So this is the slide that we were just referring to. So in the earlier sections, where there's broad agreement is in terms of the calculation of the risk adjustment and the method being used, where most firms in our survey were looking to use a one-year VAR approach. So leveraging Solvency II using a one-year-based view of risk, calibrating your non-financial risks to be based off your one in X years based on the next 1 year period. However, when we also asked the question in terms of disclosure, so will you also be disclosing the confidence level on that 1 year view, or will you be disclosing the confidence level based on an ultimate runoff view? And when we asked that question, we got a much more split view. Just one firm saying 1 year, one more firm saying 1 year, but five firms actually saying they're going to disclose on the ultimate runoff view. And what that told us was that some firms were looking to apply some sort of transformation of the 1 year view into a multi-year view. And I've got a few examples of what firms are thinking of there. Now, our view within PwC is that you should be looking to disclose your risk adjustment on an ultimate runoff view. So for those firms considering disclosing on a one-year view, we think there's a bit more work and thought to be done there. The reason we think that is because of some of the wording in the standards. So paragraph B91 talks about considering the risks over the whole lifetime of a contract, and that longer-term contracts should have a higher risk adjustment than shorter-term contracts. And there's a few other references as well, but we think taking those together, we think the risk adjustment should reflect a longer-term view of risk. Now, in terms of the practical ways firms are looking to address that and tackle that, a common approach I've seen in a few of those firms is making some simplifying assumptions. So if you assume your non-financial risks are independent and identically distributed, normally distributed usually, then you can develop a compound distribution from those and apply an adjustment factor to your one-year risks. That's quite a common approach, though it does come with challenges. So some of the more significant non-financial risks are not normal. Mass lapse, longevity, for example, are common not in the internal models are not often modeled as normal distributions. So assuming they're normally distributed and compounded raises some risk there in terms of over time that may not be appropriate and may lead to a material misstatement. So although it's a useful simplifying approach to make, I think it requires thought and justification and validation. One other firm is considering using closed-form Gaussian techniques. I haven't got too much information on that, but that's what they've told us that they're considering using to determine the long-term view. A couple of firms have internal economic capital models that already allow them to do multi-year views, so they're looking to leverage those. But I'd say this is probably one of the key areas that remains open as an industry challenge. I don't think anyone has got a really well-defined and thought-through approach to this challenge yet, and we don't think it's going to go away as far as we're aware. So I think more work is required. Next area where there's varied practice is on group treatment. So taking the diagram to the left first, so we asked firms what are they intending to disclose, at what level they're intending to disclose their risk adjustment at. Quite varied views here, so some are going to disclose only a group risk adjustment, others will be much more granular than that and are looking to disclose it at a product level as well as entity and group. There is a choice here, and I think firms will look across the market to see what level other firms, particularly their competitors, are disclosing at, because they won't want to be too out of line there. But one of the key objectives of IFRS 17 is comparability, so I think if you're markedly out of line with the market there, then you may get questions from analysts and investors there. In terms of the diagram on the right, this is quite interesting. So we asked around whether firms are going to allow for group diversification in their risk adjustment. Now, the rules do allow this if it's allowed for in pricing the compensation for risk, but only half of the firms were intending to allow for this benefit. I think some of the firms that answered no would have done so because they're not particularly large groups, and therefore the benefit of group diversification is not that beneficial for them. But there are also a few other reasons why firms are not elected to take this. So we are aware in some countries, so we've heard of Canada in particular, are not allowing firms to allow for additional group diversification, so they want their only diversification to be allowed for within the entity. That raises challenges in terms of having to therefore run parallel CSMs. If you have a Canadian entity and a UK group, then you could have different measures there for the risk adjustment and could lead to differences in the future measurement. Bank assurers as well. So certain banking rules restrict the fungibility of capital within banking groups, and therefore if you're an insurance subsidiary of a bank, some of those aren't allowing for additional group diversification as well. One of the requirements of IFRS 17 is that you should have the same risk adjustment at the entity and the group level, and that raises a practical challenge in terms of if you are allowing for group diversification, what does that mean for your entity risk adjustment? And we're seeing this tackled practically through the use of a combined scenario, but a group combined scenario, so allowing for all of your diversification within your combined scenario already, so that when you apply it at the entity and the group level, it all adds up correctly and you get the right outcome risk adjustment at the end. Next topic of disagreement was around with profits. So we asked two questions here. What are firms intending to do on the risk adjustment for with profits business in the 90-10 fund? And the same question for non-profit business in a with-profit fund. On the left, there's broadly agreement here in terms of firms are only looking to allow for the shareholder proportion of risk. So that's 10% in the 90-10 fund. A couple of firms are going to also allow for the additional burn-through costs, so where the with-profits fund requires support from the shareholder. And we think that's perfectly sensible to do. A few firms, this wasn't relevant because we had quite a range of firms, so not all firms were with-profit firms. But then for non-profit business in the with-profits fund, there's quite varied practice here, and our view is that only one firm is actually applying the rules correctly here. So some are looking take the same approach as with-profits business and with-profit funds, so to only allow for 10% allocated to shareholder. And only one firm is allowing for all of the risk associated with the non-profit business as though it was written in a non-profit fund. Now, we think there's some relevant material here from the ISB Mutual's education material, which suggests that all risks for non-profit business in a with-profit fund should be allowed for, so as though it was written in a non-profit fund. So we think that could be an area of auditor challenge as well for firms that are not doing that approach. So the next area is around negative risk adjustments. So just to explain the concept for those that aren't familiar, these could arise if you take a very simplified scenario of a firm, a life insurance company that sells annuities and protection products. When you're determining your biting direction of your mortality stress, for example, it would probably be longevity for a large annuity book and not mortality. But you'll apply that biting direction to all of your products and all of your contracts. And that may mean that for your protection products, you're allowing for a longevity stress, which may lead to a negative risk adjustment, i.e. It's a benefit you're getting there. In terms of the question we asked in our survey, we asked, if negatives do occur, do you intend to allow for them at unit account level in your IFRS 17 risk adjustment? Now, just over half the firms said yes, they will allow for it to be negative. Just under half said no, negatives will be floored at zero. Now, this is quite an interesting one, and the view does depend on who you speak to. So I think from our experience speaking to other actuaries, we're quite comfortable with the concept of it being negative from an economic point of view. So you get diversification if you sell annuities and protection products, and therefore some products will be onerous under certain stresses, others won't be. But the accounting view, and for some of our senior accountants in our firm, they just don't understand how this can be allowable from an accounting concept point of view. And our firm view is actually swaying towards the accountant's view, and we believe negative risk adjustments are not allowed under the standards. So again, it could be an area that firms need to look out for and develop their approach in, and may get audited challenge in this area. And this one's a fairly straightforward question. It's an optional choice. So within the standard, you're allowed to either disaggregate the change in the risk adjustment between insurance service result and insurance finance income or expenses. And just over half the firms were looking to take that option, and the other just under half weren't. As I say, it's optional. We put the results there as we had the results from the survey, but there's not too much to expand on that point. So that's the final slide on areas where there's quite varied practice. I'll pause there and see if there's any questions. Okay, great. I'll hand over to Rob now to go through the next section where the industry is still undecided.
Thanks. So we've covered areas of broad agreement, we've covered areas of varied proposals, should we say. This is areas the industry is undecided, so this is more about the areas that maybe people haven't quite got to yet, and there's still more work to do in the run-up to IFRS 17 going live. First point, choice of confidence interval, or confidence level. So IFRS 17, Jignesh said earlier, one of the things is about increasing comparability. One of the requirements in the aim of increased comparability is for all firms to disclose the confidence level that their risk adjustment equates to. Regardless of the approach that you take to calculate it, you need to disclose a confidence level, and the idea of that is that it will help promote comparability between different companies' results, basically. I think there's a very common thing throughout IFRS 17 that where judgments are taken or options chosen, disclosure of that should help to improve comparability. So we ask companies what confidence level they were planning on using. So this comes to the earlier point of calibration. Now, as we say, this section covers areas that some people just kind of haven't got to yet. This kind of, to me, brings me to a big kind of theme of this talk. There's a lot of areas that people won't have got to yet, and some of those you can completely understand. We have quite a lot of time still before IFRS 17 goes live, and there are topics that people just won't have got to yet. I think particularly what we're seeing throughout the market is that at the moment, system design and build is a strong driver of the prioritization of dealing with those outstanding topics. So calibration isn't something that I think people have particularly landed on yet in terms of where they're going to be with their risk adjustment calibration. And one reason for that is, to a large extent, it's not going to affect their system design or build. So there's definitely a kind of focus on prioritizing the decisions now that are going to affect that. To the extent that things might become inputs to a calculation or even just tweaks to that calculation, I think companies tend to kind of look at those as lower priority in terms of the urgency of needing to finalize these before IFRS 17 goes live. So that tended to be what we saw around the roundtable discussion on the point of a choice of confidence level. One of the points that did get some discussion, though, was how precise do you need to go with this? So as you can see from what we've had on there, we had companies thinking around a kind of range of maybe kind of 70th to 80th percentile, maybe a little bit higher. But the discussion then was on, what do I actually need to disclose here? Do I need to disclose that my risk adjustment is calculated at the 75.8th percentile? Or can I say it's 70th to 80th percentile? I'll monitor that on an ongoing basis as to whether the exact figure does stray outside those boundaries, but that's my disclosure that allows me not to have to update that and be overly precise every period. I don't have an answer to that question. That's the question that was kind of put out, I think, and discussed a bit around our roundtable. Again, it's to the point I said earlier, auditor engagement and discussion is needed, and this is an area where we need to kind of see where this one gets to, I think. But I would say that if the aim is to improve comparability, having large ranges of confidence levels probably isn't going to meet that very well. So we'll see where the industry goes on this one, but I think it's fair to say it's relatively early days for that one. Next area in terms of being undecided is around reinsurance held. So I know I already mentioned earlier, IFRS 17 requires you to calculate your risk adjustment separately for your gross business and your reinsurance held. The question that we ask participants is, how do you intend to measure it for your reinsurance held? So we had the kind of options there of, are we going to calibrate pads on a net basis, apply those to gross and net, do it implicitly using some kind of gross less net position, or calculate the risk adjustment for reinsurance directly? And this directly category was the most common response around our participants, but this is falling into the area we've called undecided. We had the roundtable discussion. As you probe into this a little bit more, I think what directly actually means in practice is one of those areas that companies still need to get to grips with a bit more and figure out, actually, how exactly am I going to do that for my reinsurance held? And to be honest, what I'm kind of seeing here is this is mirroring what I've seen from companies across their IFRS 17 implementation journeys. There's a lot to interpret, choices to understand in the standard. And the way that most companies have tended to approach that is figuring that out for the gross business written first and dealing later on with what are the implications for reinsurance. To me, what we've seen from our survey and from our roundtable discussion is a bit of a kind of mirroring of that. Risk adjustment, what am I going to do for my gross business? I know I need to calculate reinsurance separately, but I will get to that later. That seems to be the kind of general theme that we've seen. The last slide that we have in this section on areas undecided is a complete cop-out and catch-all from our part, given that it's practical challenges of implementing risk adjustment. This was almost anything else, operational aspects. So the point of this really is just to highlight that there's a number of areas people haven't thought about yet, as I say. We've kind of listed out a few of those things that that people are going to kind of start to get to grips with in terms of how frequently will I need to calibrate this model? When will I do it? How will that interact with my year-end process, my working day timetable? How will I allow for changes in the profile of my business over time? There's a reasonably long list of topics that companies will have to try and get to grips with. I think the point that I would say is there's some of these topics that's completely understandable in terms of prioritization to tackle later rather than earlier. If there's nothing particularly, as I say, the kind of pressures around system design and build, in your IFRS 17 implementation plan, if there's nothing that requires these decisions to be made now, fair enough, they may be deprioritized in favor of things that do need to be decided on now. But what I would kind of warn here is there are some of these that really are worth thinking about at the same time as, say, technical methodology decisions now. So working day timetable to me is a good example of that. It's one of the first things I brought up on the first slide where companies, first of all, thought I want to leverage Solvency II. I want to leverage something that I already do. But you need to think through the operational implications of that to a certain extent when coming up with that approach. You don't want to come up with a technical approach that you're unable to then go and implement, or it gives you problems when you go to implement it. The working day timetable example thereof, is it something that I'm going, if I'm leveraging an existing process, when does that process happen? Is it something I'm going to have available when my IFRS 17 process needs to have a risk adjustment available? I think it's also now is a good time to be thinking, how will this actually fit into my year-end process? So from what we see from companies on their implementation journeys, there's system design and build, but alongside systems, there's data, there's processes, there's people. There's needing to think through more broadly than just the technical or even just the system design aspects of this. What does this mean for my future reporting environment? So if I'm coming up with a risk adjustment methodology, what does that actually mean in terms of who's going to be owning that? Where are the handoffs? How does that fit into my year-end process? And fundamentally, how is my system going to build and carry that out? That's the last area that I have in terms of areas where industry is undecided. We've got a relatively short last section, so instead of opening it up for questions now, I'll wait till we've gone through this and we can have a Q&A session at the end, depending on how much CPD you all want.
Thanks, Rob. So next session is on implementation challenges. So we've touched on a number of these as we've gone through the talk, but I'll recap on each of them just so that you're clear on what the challenges are and some of the solutions that some firms are thinking about. So we spent some time at the beginning of my section talking about converting 1 year to ultimate stresses. I think that is still the number one challenge on risk adjustment. We haven't seen many firms really come up with a good solution to that yet. Adjustments to Solvency II. So we briefly touched on that. What we're talking about here is under Solvency II, some of the assumptions that are used for Solvency II compared to IFRS 17 may well be different. So I'm thinking of things like the discount rate and expense assumptions. So the discount rate approach is very different under IFRS 17. You take a top-down or bottom-up approach, whereas under Solvency II, there's different rules around applying the EIOPA risk-free curve plus volatility adjustment or matching adjustment where relevant. So that'll be a different assumption, and expenses will often be different as well because under IFRS 17, you should only allow for your directly attributable expenses, whereas under Solvency II, you should do fully loaded best estimate expenses. So if you're leveraging Solvency II, you should consider whether you need to make adjustments to your models to allow for those differences. And there may be contract boundary differences as well, that's another area. That's quite challenging without sort of developing a lot of adjustments in your Solvency II process. And I've not seen anyone really come up with a good way of of approaching that yet. A lot of people are trying to argue it away from a materiality perspective, but I don't know, some of these adjustments are going to be quite large, so I think that's going to be quite challenging, so it requires a bit more thought. And next, compliance with the group policy with entities that don't use Solvency II. So if you're a European-based group with entities outside of Europe, you may devise an approach for your risk adjustment which builds off your Solvency II models and capability. When you're applying that outside of Europe for your non-European entities, they may not be able to achieve those methods and capital sort of quantification techniques because they may have a much more simpler capital regime. So that needs consideration as well, and is a challenge. So I've seen some firms require their non-European entities to actually develop an internal model as such to model as close as they can to the current Solvency II approach to try and meet that requirement. Next one is around storage. So this is not just a risk adjustment challenge. This is a challenge across the whole implementation of IFRS 17. There are massive storage requirements. You need to store things at a very granular level, going back a very many number of years. A specific example within the risk adjustment is around storing your locked-in assumptions. Because when you make future changes to your risk adjustment, you need to apply, such as demographic assumption changes, you need to apply those using the locked-in discount rate. So you need to store that history over time. Now, as I say, it's not just a risk adjustment challenge, it's a challenge across IFRS 17. We're seeing a lot of firms invest a lot of time and effort into coming up with a good solution around how they're going to store all their data and have it accessible sort of for the process. Rob has already touched on fitting the risk calibration runs into tighter reporting timetables. What we're seeing at the moment is insurers thinking about taking their calibration process off cycle. So typically doing your calibration runs, say, in Q3, and using that to derive your combined scenario and applying that combined scenario during the year-end process. I think that's fine as an approach. It makes perfect sense practically. I think you just need to think about what triggers you put in place to monitor the appropriateness of that combined scenario that's derived off cycle. Because you could, for example, write a very large annuity scheme in the final quarter, which may change your risk profile significantly and may require recalibration. Reinsurance risk adjustment methodology, so Rob has already touched on that in terms of it being much further behind in development. There are different considerations there, and the risks you include may not necessarily be the same. So I think firms do need to do a bit more thinking there. Ensuring the output risk adjustment reflects the input confidence level. So what this point is getting at is that at the beginning of the process, you may derive a combined scenario. If you're deriving a combined scenario, this should be fine. But you may, if you don't have a very complex approach, you may calibrate each of your risks independently, say to target the 80th percentile, for example. But when you apply them in the process, allow for diversification, there may be non-linearity of risks, and therefore the confidence level you get on your output risk adjustment at the end may not be the same as the number you targeted at the beginning. So a good practical way around this, as we discussed earlier, is deriving a post-diversification combined scenario that allows for those effects, and therefore what you input will be what you get out at the end of the process. Rob has already touched on the use of hindsight and sourcing historical data for transition, so he spoke about that at length, so I won't cover that again. And also about applying S108 requirements from the April TRG. Just a point to note there, so this is probably most useful for protection business, as Rob mentioned, because often if you're writing protection business, you may have a loss-making contract on the gross side, but that's offset by profitable reinsurance. So you may get very odd mismatches between your gross and your reinsurance position, which if you apply S118, you net those off and just report one risk adjustment. Your reinsurance risk adjustment will be zero, but your gross position will be your net risk adjustment. So that's quite a useful rule to apply there if you're a big protection writer. And allocating diversification benefits to the appropriate level, Rob has mentioned that already. If you're applying a PADS type approach, then naturally you will allocate to the right unit of account level because you'll typically do your runs at a policy level. So there's some of the current implementation challenges we're seeing in the market. If I was to pick out maybe two of the biggest ones, I'd say converting 1 year to ultimate stress and reinsurance are probably areas where we require quite a lot more work in the industry. Okay, I'll hand back over to Rob now to conclude the talk.
Thanks, Jignesh. So, I think in summary, what we've seen from our survey and from our roundtable that we've talked through tonight, there's broad agreement among UK companies at the very highest level when it comes to the risk adjustment and the challenges of implementing that for IFRS 17. That broad agreement quickly breaks down as you get into some of the detail. I think there are outstanding areas where companies aren't agreed and probably need to be resolved before IFRS 17 goes live. Discussion throughout industry, discussion with auditors especially, I think is going to help with that. There's overall a desire to leverage existing methods that we've talked about, but as we've said, I think there are issues that companies will find with that that, again, need to tackle and need to resolve. I think in general what we're seeing is there's a range of operational issues or challenges that maybe haven't been dealt with yet. As I said, I think some of those, to me, it's completely understandable to deprioritise or to prioritise the more urgent, more pressing issues in IFRS 17 implementation. But I think it is fair that some of those, now is a good time for insurers to start thinking more about some of those operational challenges and thinking more broadly about the implications on their year-end process, their reporting environment, when tackling some of the technical issues with the risk adjustment now. So, thank you. That concludes our talk. So we'll move on to questions and comments. I think we have a roving mic around the room. And any questions? Reminder that there's two bottles of champagne behind there as well.
Did you mention at the start that the risk adjustment is compensation for kind of non-financial risks? And therefore, I wondered kind of how akin is it to the risk margin and Solvency II risk margin? And I wondered on from that, kind of given all the issues around that, kind of why, if that's all true, why insurers are so keen to bring Solvency II into the risk adjustment, given it's been so challenging under Solvency II. But I may have misunderstood some of the points you were making.
I think... In terms of why would insurers be so keen to bring Solvency II risk adjustment in, I think it's more from the perspective of what can I leverage, what can I use that I already have. So even if companies have found issues with implementing the Solvency II risk adjustment, if it's now something that's bedded down in a business as usual process, I think there's a thought of, do I have to create something entirely new here for IFRS 17? I think that's particularly a thought for companies where IFRS 17 isn't their primary reporting metric. So where it may be more about minimum compliance, how do I do this, implement this as efficiently, as cost effectively as possible, there's definitely a desire to leverage what already exists. Were there particular kind of issues or problems that you've come across that you were wondering why firms would want to kind of replicate that for IFRS or?
You may have heard that. I was just saying, obviously, the risk margin has been a huge topic for Solvency II and the volatility of it.
Yeah.
I was wondering if there's something about the kind of IFRS 17 that means it's not an issue in IFRS 17.
Yes, I think it's worth just clarifying the points that we made. So when we were talking about leveraging Solvency II, we were talking about leveraging the capital models, so the SCR models. I think the very first slide we said was that only one firm was looking to use a cost of capital method, which is typical method used for Solvency risk margin. So because of the volatility that is brought about through that method, so it's very dependent on the discount rate, for example, highly penal for longevity risk and for sort of annuity writers. So it's firms aren't looking to leverage that method. They're looking to leverage the solvency to internal models, typically, because they've got the risk calibration techniques and models already available, and apply that to a VAR type approach. So using those models to calibrate a certain percentile on the loss distribution, apply that as a margin on top of the best estimate, and run it that way rather than through a cost of capital approach. Is that clear?
So the question of would the volatility not be an issue? It would, yeah. It, as in the volatility still would be an issue if you were following that same approach.
Hello,
I'm Charles Pickup. I'm a fellow. You mentioned on a few occasions needing to or advising to talk to auditors frequently and on many topics. Given that companies are under increasing pressure to change their auditors periodically, is there any process in place to try to get some kind of consistency of view amongst different audit firms so that you don't find that one year everything's hunky-dory, then you change auditors and all of a sudden you've got a hell of a problem and you can't change things very much because, as I understand it, things get pretty much set in stone with IFRS 17.
I think it's, to me, it's probably less about a process to ensure consistency. It's more active discussion throughout industry. People do talk. So I think when you have kind of audit and advisory firms or audit firms advising clients as well on approaches, you will get enough active discussion throughout industry without there needing to be a process in place to try and ensure consistency between big four firms, in my view.
Yeah, I would add, I think it is a challenge. So a couple of our audit firms are being transitioned over the period now ahead of implementation. And it is quite challenging for them to know who to engage with. Is it us or their new auditor? In terms of audit firms getting together to kind of agree views, I don't think that would be sort of in line with the competition rules, and we wouldn't really be allowed to do that. Because I guess we need to maintain our independence as a firm and have our own views. So I think that would be challenging.
Hi there. Thank you both for that presentation. It's really interesting to see what other companies are thinking about on many of these areas. And actually, I thought your first slide was actually really interesting, the fact that so many companies are taking a VAR-based approach to the risk adjustment. Because looking at it purely from a theoretical point of view, I would have thought it is much more analogous to the risk margin in Solvency II. And given that there's less prescription in IFRS 17, companies would be able to choose their own cost of capital for a cost of capital approach. And that's where the main issue has been with the risk margin, the high level of the cost of capital. So I'm just surprised that so few companies have taken the theoretically more correct, the long-term risk margin type approach. And I wonder how much of that could be dictated. It was quite a small sample that you looked at, and I wonder how much that could have been possibly biased by maybe firms who already have an internal model. They will look at this differently compared to firms who have a standard formula approach.
Yeah, that's right. So I think you're right. It is biased by those firms that have internal models. I think out of our sample, over 10 of them had internal models. I can't remember the exact number. It was the larger UK life insurers. In terms of the theoretical question, I think you're right. With cost of capital, it's a lot more easy to relate it to sort of a pricing type view, a compensation for risk, because you have the percentage that you apply to the cost of capital rate. So that's a very clear linkage there. The trouble that we've seen that firms have with that is then one of the requirements is you have to publicly disclose the confidence level. And so that requires some sort of transformation of a pound amount number into a percentile on the risk distribution. And therefore, you have to have a method of deriving that distribution, which probably requires some sort of capital modeling. So if you're going to use the capital model anyway to derive the confidence level, firms are sort of going down the route of using that fully for the whole calculation. But also that, and then just one more point, in terms of, yes, you can reduce the cost of capital percentage, so 6%, a lot of firms are arguing is very high, but then what do you move that to and how do you justify that? I think firms have been challenged by that as well, and I guess justifying that to your auditor, comparability to other firms as well might be difficult, so I think that's where they're finding the challenges there.
Any other questions? Okay, thank you very much both for your talk. Just to thanks the audience for all the questions you've asked, and to award the best question for a fellow to, was it Charles? Yourself? About the auditors? So if you just come up at the end and I can give you your bottle. Just two quick reminders, one to complete the online survey about the talk, and the other one to join us if you can after the talk in the room behind you, just for a few small drinks and refreshments. And just to draw a meeting to a close by thanking our speakers in the usual way.